Hello, this is Dan Le Batard, and one of the things that we'd like to do with South Beach Sessions is get you to get to know some of my friends a little bit better. I've been covering sports a long time, and in the history of covering sports, I don't believe I've met anyone smarter than the guests that we have on today. Many, many years ago, I used to do a Sunday morning show, and I had the three smartest guys in the NBA on every other week, Donald Foyle, Shane Battier, and this guy. And his story is fascinating for a number of different reasons, not the least of which is he was trying to come out to me for a long time, and I didn't see it because I'm an idiot. And I'm sitting there in his house, and he's got Queer Eye for the Straight Guy on his queue and rainbow flags all over the place, and I still don't see it because, like I said, I'm just an idiot. And
you are the living embodiment of the John Travolta Pulp Fiction scene.
It is
a code in one hand and a bunch of rainbow flags surrounding you, not understanding that you're on the precipice of what might be the greatest journalistic scoop your entire career.
It was right under my nose. That's correct. Because at that point, there were no gay athletes. So I had to keep that secret for him. There were no gay athletes.
Well, there probably were,
no,
Dan.
No, publicly gay.
Openly one.
Thank you, Billy. Appreciate the commentary from back there. There were no openly gay athletes. So I was wandering around with this secret of his, and I gotta be honest. I come from Latin upbringing. My grandparents were homophobic. I didn't know any better. I was homophobic until I saw this man and was like, wait a minute. I respect this human being too much to hang on to stupidities. And he really did teach me a lot that I didn't know about how hard it is to be gay in the arena of sports. Anyways, that's just one of the things that he is, and it's not one of the most interesting things that he is. So we'll get to John Amici in a second, but first here's Mike Ryan to tell you why it is that this is all free for you.
Dan, today's South Beach Session is made possible by the fine folks at ZipRecruiter. As you know, hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart, and growing businesses connect qualified candidates. Codable co-founder Gretchen Huebner experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a new game artist to grow with her education tech company. But then she switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference. And you can too by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. No, it finds them for you. And by using ZipRecruiter screening questions to filter candidates, Gretchen found it easier to focus on the best ones. Then find the right one. In fact, after posting her job on ZipRecruiter, Gretchen said she was honestly surprised she found qualified applicants so quickly and hired a new game artist within less than 2 weeks. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH.
All right, one of the smartest people you will ever hear on the radio, podcast, in the media. Here he is, John Amici. Longtime listeners of the stuff we do know this guy. John Amici has been with us for a long time. I've always found him fascinating when he was playing in the NBA. He was a Renaissance man. He thought differently. And way back then, we were doing a Sunday morning radio show occasionally where he would call because he wanted to talk about art or something else. He's as smart a person as I've met inside or outside of sports. He's now doing consulting for big corporations, and he's a psychologist. So with those as the bona fides, John Amici is joining us now to just sort of talk about his life and his journey because, John, I really thought at one point that you and I were going to be joined at the hip with the telling of the story while you were in the NBA. That you were gay. I don't mean to catch you off guard by starting right there because I know that you don't like to be associated with just the gay thing, but I really did think that you and I were going to be attached at the hip because I thought that was a story you were going to tell through me while you were in the league.
Yeah, I mean, I still think we're attached at the hip by that story. I don't think many people, whether it's through the ESPN, the magazine article that you wrote about me, before or the one you wrote afterwards, after I came out, I think we're still kind of attached to the hip. I look back and I think it would have been there's part of me that says it would have been lovely to be that vanguard at that moment, but I understand very clearly. I understood very clearly from my experience in Utah that, you know, there were lots of bits about me that put me in jeopardy, being an uppity Brit, being just one of them. But being a gay uppity Brit was putting my, well, it did. It put my career in jeopardy and made life very difficult. And I just kind of wanted to escape it. I've told you before, part of me, when I retired, I was supposed to go to New York. I think it was Christmas of 2005, maybe. And I went home. I was back home. And I didn't ever plan on ever coming back to America or having any real influence there. And I planned on just coming out. And I imagined that nobody, well, I mean, I was already out to family and friends, but if it was going to be in a larger way, it would just be organic. And I didn't imagine I'd ever really interact again on that front, certainly within sports and in the United States. I've revised my thoughts on that over the years, and I'm trying to continue to have a positive impact. But at that time, I just wanted to do my job and get home to England as quickly as possible.
Can you explain to anybody in ways that would help us understand how lonely an existence that is, to stifle a piece of yourself that way?
I think the loneliness is one aspect of it. I've said before, part of why I got to be any good at basketball, and at this point many people will remind me that I was kind of average, but part of the reason I got to be kind of average from never having touched a basketball before the age of 17 was an incredibly singular focus. So lots of things, had I been a straight person, lots of things would have been eschewed, would have been thrown to the wayside in order for me to remain singularly focused, because I just wasn't talented enough physically to be carried by that. I needed everything else working in my favor. So the loneliness is one element of it. I think what people perhaps do not recognize is the amount of energy it requires, that it has to be funneled away from your primary focus, putting a ball in a hole. The amount of energy that has to be funneled to the side in order to use the right pronouns, in order to deflect the wounding barbs that you hear from people who are your friends, and people who love you as teammates, but in the course of your interactions with them say things that really wound you, but that you can't respond to, lest you cause an additional challenge. And I would also add, this is kind of nuanced, because there were teams that I was on where people knew I was gay and didn't ask any questions and didn't want to know anything, but certainly didn't make me feel marginalized in any way. And then there were other teams where it was clear it was a challenge for some people. But the energy it required all the time, you know, it made me a worse basketball player. It made playing harder, doing my job harder.
Can you explain that to us, though? The energy, and you did some, but I mean, what kind of challenges were there in perpetually concealing?
To not be able to have a position when people say, and it's less now than it used to be, certainly within NBA confines, but it used to be that you could hear, you know, pretty blatant homophobia on a regular basis, that was pretty raw. And it was said in jest, because people knew, in kind of air quotes, that there was nobody gay in this locker room, therefore we can say this. We are free to mock, marginalize, or say terrible things about gay people and gay stories. And so there's part of you that just braces for impact when you hear somebody start a diatribe, when a gay person appears on television in the locker room, on the news, or there's a story about them, or it's an out celebrity. You brace yourself for people to make those comments. And even when it's not, you know, when it's not the F word, or when it's not something truly heinous, it's just it's death by a thousand tiny paper cuts, where you just hear people who on the one hand throw their arms around you, and support you when you miss that big shot. On the one hand are there for you should a reporter make a disparaging comment, or a fan yell something at you, or even the coach or another player get on you for no reason. And then on the other hand, they say the most wounding things about the very core of who you are.
Do you remember the one that cut the most? Do you remember the specifics of being in a locker room and having one slice you because it was somebody that you didn't think would do that?
I honestly don't. I had, you know, every once in a while I kind of reminisce on that, and I don't. The thing for me that it just became a more clinical exercise as I got older. It's no less energy expensive, but as I moved on in years in the league, it became a more clinical exercise. So I actually, you know, there was a driving past a billboard that had the equivalent of the kind of the modern message now, which is some people are gay, get over it. And there's a message like that, and just sliding my headphone off slightly off one ear to listen to what I knew would come. And there it came from people who were my teammates and my friends, hearing them talk about if their son was gay, they'd kill him. If they knew anybody gay, they wouldn't allow that. Then, you know, the various noises and whatever else that were showing people's echoed agreement in the disgust that they felt. And by that point, I think, I knew I needed to get out, but B, it was a clinical exercise. I would just listen to confirm what I knew to be true.
I heard a story not but 3 or 4 years ago about a team flight involving a star player and the guys having a conversation throughout about whether you would prefer your child to be gay or to be a porn star. The team came down pretty strong on the idea of I'd prefer porn.
I mean, I suppose it surprises me a little bit because I find judgment on either one of those rather difficult. I didn't realize that basketball players' morals, or even any athlete's morals, were so evolved that porn would be something that they would neither consume and thereby judge. I don't even understand the equivalence between being a porn star and being gay. It misses the very fundamental point that whilst being a porn star is for some people not a very active choice and not a choice that they have much agency in, at least it is there is a decision to be made there. Whereas being gay, less of a decision. It's just horrible to know that, I mean, I'm not naive. I know this still goes on, but it just seems crazy to me at this stage that as a parent in the 2000s, people haven't figured out that the way you fail your child is by having your love be conditional on them being exactly who you want them to be. You've missed the point of being a parent entirely.
The reason I bring up that story, though, is because it's just to illustrate, even now, even as we're just a few years removed from it, that some things haven't changed. That place, sports, can be very difficult in that regard. I don't think, though, that I've been a lot more surprised in my life than when Tim Hardaway on our radio show said flatly, as you were selling your book, and we had just been talking about your book, that he hated gay people. And I remember, you know, that blew up and it was an explosion and it was unpleasant. I felt physically sick in the parking lot because I knew something was coming that was bad for people. And I didn't mean to get Tim Hardaway in trouble. But I remember calling you after that and your reaction. I thought your reaction would have been disappointment. And your reaction instead at the time was, I am so glad somebody finally said it out loud and put their name on it. I am so glad that somebody was finally honest enough to say how they really felt about their hatred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in a sense, everybody in PR around me was trying to tell me not to say this publicly. But in a sense, it was just a relief to have somebody state the truth, because otherwise we sit behind this fog of cordiality. Of superficial pleasantness, where we pretend, oh, no, I know people who hate gay people, but I'm not one of those people. I may not approve of their lifestyle or similar phrases, but I don't hate gay people because I'm a sophisticated New York Times reader, or I'm just a proper Christian, or whatever else. I don't hate. I love. It was just lovely. For once, especially given when Tim said what he said, it galvanized a huge number of people. That tends to be what happens when ignorant people in positions of power speak out loudly, they galvanize the people around them. And so there was this echo chamber of people actually saying what they really thought, which was really powerful, I think, and important, because one of the challenges that I faced in that moment and still face to this day, and indeed in the work we do inside organizations, is that the people deny the status quo. They like to believe that we're evolved now. So misogyny is not real. Women are just snowflakes. Homophobia is not real. Gay people are just too demanding and entitled. There is no racism. After all, we had Obama, so that's over. And black people are just being picky. And while people deny the status quo, even the softest of responses to that, to the actual status quo, like kneeling at a national anthem, will seem entirely unreasonable. To anybody who denies the status quo, the merest inkling, the merest act of defiance that seeks to recognize, that seeks to highlight the terrible things going on in the status quo, will seem like the act of a deranged kind of insurgent. And that's where we are right now. So I was grateful to Tim, because when he did that, people couldn't any longer say, oh no, it's 2007. This is an evolved world where gay people are allowed to be whatever they want to be. And whilst technically that might have been true and may be true now, it hides the fact that there's a huge number of people who hold great animus to anybody different than themselves.
You mentioned kneeling, so I'm curious how this has looked to you as someone who is not in this country, as someone who doesn't really care about sports that much now that you've left sports. I'm curious from over there how you view everything that's happened with the kneeling in this country.
So, this will surprise nobody. I am a fan of what Colin Kaepernick has done. I'm a fan because of how he comports himself. I'm a fan because of the way he has continued to raise money, has continued to shine a spotlight on ongoing injustice. Nothing about his treatment at the hands of the NFL surprises me. To me, it is a clear case of what in the UK, what in the EU we'd call constructive dismissal. The idea that you have all the capabilities to deliver on the job, but you are essentially blackballed or exited from that job for reasons that aren't about your capabilities. To me, he's a man of principle, a full-time man of principle, and he is willing to sacrifice for that. And people will argue now because they'll say, well, he's getting paid by Nike, so everything's fine. But if you're a person whose life goal is to compete at the highest level in your sport and you're being denied that opportunity, even tangential income doesn't make up for that lack of ability to express your identity in the way he wants to. Britain broadly doesn't really understand the dynamics of the NFL, doesn't understand what an interesting cabal it is. And I don't think they have a real idea, but what they are certain of is that he's not protesting the anthem, which is curious because you can't listen to anything, mostly on ESPN or anywhere else. You can't listen to anybody, even on whatever side of the coin they happen to stand, whether they support Kaepernick and what he's standing for or kneeling for, or whether they don't. Everybody says he's protesting the anthem, and it muddies the water, and nobody understands why they're doing that. In England, where partly because we don't have drugs, we have plenty of problems with differential policing, but we tend not to get our brains blown out in our own living room. In England, we're clearly understanding that what he's doing is using his power and influence to protest a structural injustice. And the weird part for me is that is what I was always told from the very second I arrived in the United States. That's what I was told I was supposed to do. I was told that now I'm an athlete in Toledo, Ohio, at a Jesuit high school in Toledo, Ohio. Now I'm a role model. When I got to Penn State, I was told, now I'm a role model, and that requires that I stand up for something, and that something is not something that relates to sport. I was involved in drug and alcohol rehabilitation causes. I was involved in all kinds of stuff, Big Brothers, Big Sisters. And I was told that when I did that, I should feel proud, but I shouldn't feel special because that's what I was supposed to do. That's what role models do. And so it's curious to me that now Cap's doing this and LeBron's doing what he's doing and numerous other people who aren't getting the plaudits are doing things out there. They are being told to shut up and play ball. It's remarkable to me that there's an entire country or a part of a country that seems satisfied that an athlete would sell them sugar water, which doesn't work, or that an athlete would sell them, you know, shoes made by Cambodian children. But when an athlete stands up for the unjust murder by the very authorities that are supposed to protect and serve, then they've overstepped. It's crazy to me.
Well, it does show you, though, it's a bit instructive in terms of taking on causes. I remember one of the first times that I talked to you, you thought back then that an athlete of Michael Jordan's stature could end famine if he took on causes like the kinds of causes that we're talking about. You actually think that still, I imagine, right? That if LeBron James was trying to end world hunger, he would.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're talking about the confines of the country, that's probably where we have to limit it. There are socio-political, geopolitical forces beyond even the power of LeBron James or Michael Jordan, frankly. But within America, and for the Premier League players in this country, football players within the United Kingdom, and the same for other countries, one pivotal role model who gathers around him or herself a group of similarly high profile athletes could force so much attention on an issue that it forced politicians to either align with them or explain why they're not aligning with them, and politicians are not great at explaining why they're not aligning with something that becomes a cause célèbre. And yeah, I do think that Michael Jordan is, he's obviously a remarkable athlete and amazing at creating his own brand and building on that. You can't hold any of that against him. But to me, in order to become, in order to transcend race in his particular case, he forgot, or at least didn't bother to focus on some of the issues that his status could have impacted. He didn't challenge politicians running in his own states on clearly racist grounds. He didn't use his power for good. And what use is power if you're not going to use it for good?
What LeBron has done, I'm sure, has gotten your attention, even though it's not doing things like curing famine. He is doing things that are unlike most American athletes who have come before him in terms of just putting his fingerprints on his community.
Yep, it's a remarkably nuanced thing he's done too. I mean, if you look at the multiple layers of what his school is doing, one of my colleagues is a professor of pedagogy, which is a posh way of saying he knows how people learn, and he teaches teachers how to cheat, and he understands how to create learning cultures. And so many of the pieces of what's being done at his Promise School are exactly what would be recommended by science. So it's a remarkably nuanced job he's doing. It's not just, I've opened a school and that's it. It does seem like he's really brought together a group of experts who know what it takes for a young person to best learn, to best be resilient, and to best get the kind of holistic education that prepares them for life, which is, I mean, it's amazingly cool. In some sense, I know it seems like jumping from criticizing Michael Jordan for not changing the entire country in terms of child poverty to lauding LeBron James for opening a school. I know that seems like a big jump, but it's what LeBron James is doing is still rare. And yet there are so many people out there who could be doing so much more.
It gets wasted, right? Like, I'm curious how did you experience everything that happened with Ali's death? when you're over there, and I don't know whether you were reading about this at all, but the idea that the other day I was watching an NBA awards ceremony, and I'm watching Oscar Robertson up there, and Bill Russell's wandering around, and these guys look old, and these were legitimate civil rights activists. These were guys mm-hmm. like Bill Russell that were really in the fray with Jim Brown at a time that it was turbulent in America. And those guys are old, John, at this banquet. These former symbols for youth and vitality and strength, they're all old, and they're still talking about the same stuff that they were talking about 70 years ago.
Yeah, that's the depressing part. That's the depressing part. I've been reading a lot of James Baldwin lately, and this is a man with 1,000 amazing quotes. I aspire to be James Baldwin one day, but he has this amazing quote where he says, "To be a Negro in America and relatively conscious means to be angry all the time." And my accent and the number of syllables in the words that I use does not betray this, but I increasingly feel this sense of boiling, incendiary anger that we live in a world where people want to bloody well pat themselves on the back and congratulate themselves for incremental change at no inconvenience to themselves, whilst knowing that that approach to change means that nothing ever really does, nothing of substance ever really does. And here we are with human rights leaders of yesteryear still saying the same things they ever were, while the change that they sought 40 years ago remains elusive, and whenever a new person takes up the mantle to try and re-energize the fight and make that change happen, he finds themselves in a modern day corporate lynching.
What do you do with that? How did you get to rage? I didn't realize you were at boiling already. You are someone who is in control of your emotions. You do not...
Oh, I'm in control of it because I can't afford not to be in control of it, because I know what happens if I get angry. You can't afford to get angry. And so what I have to do is focus on the science, focus on the research, focus on the kind of work that I can do in the organizations I work with to see if I can make a difference without making me the focus. Because I know that when I'm the focus, people can use me as a distraction. So the work that I do tends to be in the background. It tends nowadays not necessarily be me berating somebody from a pulpit or writing an incendiary op-ed, but rather working inside government, inside organizations to try and make change. But part of my energy source is this well of gently swirling magma.
John, I know people like to come at you by saying you're too outspoken for someone who wasn't that good at basketball, who used the fame in basketball to become an arrogant gas bag who opines on everything, and that you weren't really good at basketball. But you made it to the top 1% of the 1% to play professional basketball, and I don't think people have any earthly idea how hard that was coming from where you were coming from.
The era that certainly began in the NBA in 95 was an era where there were just a tiny number of foreign players, and they were Eastern European for the most part, Petrovic and Vlade Divac and people of that ilk, and I was a fat, bookish British kid. I mean, I've told you this before, my life at that point revolved around consuming books and eating pie. That was really where I was most comfortable. Sweating was not a fun thing for me. And I was... People mistake. They think I found basketball and I thought, here's a route to international fame and money. And that was nothing to do with it. I started basketball because I walked into a gym wearing my rugby kit because it was all I had. And I walked into this gym and I looked at the faces of the 12 or 15 people in there, and they ran towards me, grabbed my arms, and were saying, he's on our team. They framed every terrible thing I did, and everybody knows what it's like to be a total novice. Unable to catch the ball, unable to get within 6 feet of the basket, not a clue about what you're supposed to be doing on the floor tactically. And every mistake I made, they framed as a pathway to my future greatness. And I just knew, as these people looked at me and all I could see reflected in their faces was my potential, I just knew I would never leave this space, that I needed to find a way to stay in this space as long as possible. And that's why I wanted to play in the NBA. Because I thought if a smelly gym in some random part of the north of England, if I could find in this space my potential, how amazing might it be if I could go to the home of basketball where there's the best coaches and bigger gyms, that experience would be magnified 1,000 times. And that's what made me want to play in the NBA.
Didn't your initial backboard, wasn't it against a wall?
I twisted my ankles so many times. So many times. You'd go up for a layup, one of your feet would be on the wall, the other of your feet would be like in the crux of the wall to the floor. And it would just be a regular part of our sessions where, you know, at 6 or 10 minute intervals, somebody's gone in for a contested layup. Somebody comes down in the crack in the, you know, that crux in the wall and has twisted their ankle and we're just going to take a breather. and they'd walk it off and then we'd go again.
But it was partly because England didn't really have basketball, right? It seems like we're speaking of ancient primitive times, but that's why it was, right? The basket was against the wall because nobody playing knew any better.
Oh, yeah. The thing with basketball back then is nobody played. It was super expensive to get the proper backboard. So very often they were pieces of plywood with netball hoops in it. And netball hoops are smaller. They're half the size. A basketball only just goes through them. I played on one of those for the first 6 months of my career. I certainly, that's what I had at home. I had a netball hoop. That's what I practiced on. It had no backboard. Basketball was not a part of our infrastructure. It is much more now in the UK, but the sport is still not particularly evolved. But back then it was like a tiny cabal of people. You would know once you played for a year, you'd pretty much know everybody in the country who played basketball. That's how small it was.
And so how would you explain to people how difficult it was to go from that, how bad you were at the beginning? You didn't pick up a basketball till late, right?
Yep, 17 years old, I picked up a basketball. That whole experience of meeting those people was when I was 17. I played for 1 year in the UK. I was very fortunate to have a coach who sadly, he passed away this year, a guy called Dave McLean who told me I had to go because there was nothing more that I could learn in the UK. And that's when I made that venture to go over to America. And I did that by writing to American high schools. I found a book from the Fulbright Commission, which is an organization that facilitates international exchange. And it had lists of high schools in it. And I simply found this book and went through and put a pin every once in a while in a page until I had about 3,000 names of schools. And I wrote to the coaches of those schools and invited myself onto their teams. The letter was not nuanced, and I'm embarrassed about it now, but it essentially said, "Dear coach, whatever your name is, my name's John Amici. I'm 6'9", black and English, and I would like to play for your team. If this is of interest to you, please get in touch."
The 6'9 is of interest. The 6'9.
Yes,
is.
The 6'9 and the black, I thought both would be of interest. I thought these are key pieces of information.
Yes, but the English, you threw in the English. I'm not sure what you were trying to accomplish there.
Well, I just didn't want them to have some idea that perhaps it was an American who already knew the sport and it was a expat family on a military base or something. I wanted them to realize, no. Raw. English equals I'm terrible right now. that was really the key. And I sent off 3,000 letters, because this was before email, and I got three replies. One from a famous school in New Jersey, which I will always remember, because they sent me a letter back saying, "We are the winningest team in the history of New Jersey, we don't need foreign talent. And I'm always amazed by that, the fact that they wrote back.
That is, no, that they wrote back, but to just to put you in your place with a go bleep yourself is amazingly
exactly.
cruel. It's amazingly cruel. What a great
And if
story.
Anybody wonders why I'm pompous, it is that email, that letter, that caused it. Because I remember reading that and thinking, well, I don't want to go to this school anyway, because winningness is not a word.
Why did you take the time to write that? And I mean, you took the time to write me back. Just don't write me back in that situation.
Exactly. Do what the other 2,900 odd did and ignore this as some nonsense. But instead, you want to tell me that you're the winningest school, not a word. Anyway. So, and then I got a letter from a school.
You're such a dick.
Of course I am.
Not
of
a
course.
Word.
There is nobody who does not realize this already. But I'm a principal dick, and that's important. And then I got a letter from a school in Toledo, Ohio. And I was back, actually. I was back this year to see my school court get named after Coach Ed Heinchel in Toledo, Ohio. He was the one who kind of really accelerated my development. He understood very clearly that I had 1 year to go from being abjectly terrible to being good enough to get a scholarship. And he and his assistant coach, a man called Bud Fellhaber, they dedicated themselves and forced me to dedicate myself to becoming the kind of player who could get a scholarship. It's a remarkable... That's the thing about success. It's all in the minutiae. It's in the mundane. My success is in... my willingness to write 3,000 letters, knowing that 1,000 wouldn't do it. My success is knowing that I'm never going to be the best at doing everything, but I'm tough to beat going left. I can't do much else, but I was tough to beat going left. And just that minutia is what gets it done.
Did you give me the third letter? Did you tell us what the third letter was that you got there? Because the first one's memorable, the second one's memorable. What was the third one?
The third letter was a school in Virginia, and it's only memorable because I did not go there, because my mother wouldn't let me, because it was Virginia. My mother was a white woman married to a black man in Boston in the 60s, and she would not let me go to Virginia. She was afraid.
Wow. So you had the scholarship offer. If the other one doesn't come through, that would have been your only opportunity, and your mom wouldn't let you. She wouldn't have let you go chase your dream.
Not in Virginia.
Huh. That's interesting. I did not know that. I did know the story, though, involving your mother, and I've reminisced over the years with you about this because of how it hit me when you told me. I found the words a bit haunting and sad because you told me that on her deathbed, she said to you, after that life that she lived, she said, I have not lived a fun life, but I have lived a full life.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't haunt me. It's aspirational for me. I don't need my life to be fun. And I want to be clear. I don't think she was talking about never having moments of joy. I don't think it's rose-tinted glasses to say that I know that her children... as we grow up, my two sisters and myself were part, episodically, if at least, of moments of joy for my mother. I know her friendships with colleagues and her friends throughout her life were joyful, but she had an incredibly tough life, and I think that colored the equation for her. This is a woman who fought in the Biafran War. This is a woman who jumped out of planes and ate grubs in the jungle in order to survive, and was on the losing side of a war where a massive swathe of ethnic cleansing took place. So there was nothing surprising when she said to me before she passed away that her life hadn't been fun, per se. But what was reassuring is to know that what was important to her is that it was full. And when she said that word, I knew she meant purpose, meaning, value, that she'd done something that made a difference. And boy, did she.
At what time did you feel the most sense of purpose?
No, I continue to. It rises. It continues to rise. Every day you see something else. And if you really apply your brain and are willing to add a little bit of effort, you realize that there are some things you can't impact, and to focus on them and try and be a hashtag warrior with them has only a minimal impact. And then there are some things that you really can make a difference in. So I realized there was stuff going on in sports that is really damaging, and you and I have talked about the Penn State debacle, the thing that really it's wounded clearly my relationship with not with Penn State as an entity, but with other Penn Staters, the Sandusky debacle. But even before that, I was aware that there were non-optimal things going on in sport, and now I'm in a position to do something about that. Because I can join in this country, we have a different a parliamentary system where we have two chambers, House of Commons and the House of Lords, which is the upper chamber. And I could join with members of the House of Lords to do a proper review of the duty of care in sport and make a difference. It's not glamorous, and probably not one person listening to this gives a damn about it as a piece of work. But what it did was force the institutions in this country to apply new standards to how young people are monitored, treated, and cared for, whether they be in a gym in the north of England playing a sport for the first time, or whether they be on center court at the US Open.
You've dedicated your life in some ways to those kinds of pursuits, wouldn't you say?
No. I am selfish and many other terrible things alongside. I simply, I have a slightly overdeveloped justice bone, and nobody should be under any illusions. Nobody listens to me is under any illusions that the amount of pleasure it gives me to eviscerate a moron on an issue and allow an issue through my particular style to get some focus and try and achieve some change. My ego is wrapped around the stuff that I do. I am not a James Baldwin. I am not a Colin Kaepernick. I am not in their, I'm not a LeBron James. I'm not in their league. They do stuff better. Simply get a lot of personal pleasure.
Okay.
From doing what I'm doing.
No, but you're also an activist, and you also care about people, and you also built, like, when I talk about dedicating your life to these kind of pursuits, I don't think that I've known you to have a greater cause than the gym that you were running in England, because of the way that you were impacting young people, or the way that you always made sure to, after that horrible story involving you not returning a phone call fast enough and a gay kid hung himself because you weren't able to get there fast enough to talk to him. Like, you have dedicated your life to some of these causes.
I don't think it's helpful to look at what someone like me does as anything but normal. I bang on all the time about never being a part-time person of principle. I still have time for wine. I still have time for music, though I don't dance much. I still have time for the commercial work that I do. I simply make time for this other stuff too, in part because that is part of my job description as a human being with a profile that is at least a little bit international. A human being with access to people in power and the ability to influence them with my mind. That is my job. So I think we have to be clear that it's not like I have sacrificed everything in order to do this. I simply integrate this type of work into my life. And yes, there will be times where clients will say, yeah, we don't want to work with you because of what you said about the NFL. That happens. Or what I said about the NCAA. That happens. Or what I say about child abuse. That happens. All of that. We had a client who commented on my, you perhaps won't remember, my Jerry Jones diatribe that I had on your show once. And they weren't going to work with me because they were on a board with Jerry Jones and they didn't think it was appropriate. But that's the level of sacrifice I've had to deal with nowadays. And that's, in the scheme of things, it's totally worth it.
Okay, fair enough. What are you doing now? I know, but I don't think the audience does. And it's a fairly remarkable career turn. I don't know that a lot of former professional basketball players are doing exactly what this guy is doing now with his life.
So I'm an organizational psychologist, which means I help people understand their culture and leadership, internal communications, how to engage and motivate their people. We work with an amazingly broad cross-section of organizations from the NSA and some of the intelligence services in the UK all the way through to big firms in the tech and retail industry that you would all know the names of. That's kind of my day job. I also am a non-executive director of the country's of the UK's largest hospital trust. So we obviously have a different evil socialized medicine system where your services are free at the point of service. And we've got 20,000 employees, 11 hospitals that service a population group of 3 or so million people. And I'm working to try and make sure that no matter where you come from, no matter your income level, no matter your station in life, you have the best possible chance to thrive as a human being. So there's lots of cool stuff. I mean, that just scratches at the surface. I like to have my fingers in as many pies as possible. I just feel like we're here for a finite amount of time. I happen to be one of those people who believe that when my brain shuts off, that's it. I'm gone. The only way I live on is not through some radical reincarnation or anything else, but it'll just be because in the recesses of somebody's little gray cells, a story that I told, an action that I took, something will live on. That'll be it. So I'm trying to pack in as many opportunities to sit in people's brains as possible.
Buddy, it's always good catching up with you. Thank you for making the time. I look forward to seeing you a little bit down the road here in Miami.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Dan, on the list of mistakes you've made throughout your career, obviously, you buried the lead when it came to the Dallas Cowboys White House scandal.
Right. For those of you who do not know, the Dallas Cowboys as champions had a house where they had sex with women who weren't their wives. They called it the White House. That was in an 18th paragraph of mine in a Super Bowl column about Eric Rett.
Where does not getting to publish the story about America's first, well, the world's first openly gay basketball player coming out rank on your list of missed achievements?
I can't get over the fact, okay, because you're not going to out him. That's not something you're going to do against his will. But I really thought at one point that I was going to have to be on ESPN as the advocate for him and this in ways that would have been journalistically meaningful. But even when he did come out, he came out after his career. He came out in a book in a tightly controlled setting. And I remember he called me and he was hyperventilating. He was so scared. Like that was a secret that he trusted me with. So I thought I was going to be the journalist who broke that story and advocated on behalf of America's first gay team sports athlete. But
instead, you were just a good friend. To that, we say thank you, Dan. Thank you,
no,
Dan.
No, I don't deserve all of that.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Dan. If you also want to thank Dan Levitard, head over to levitardaf.shop.
That doesn't thank me.
Yes, no, thanks you, certainly. Thank him with your mighty dollar. Go to levitardaf.shop. We have a Black Friday sale that's been extended through December 6th, where you can get 20% off on Dan Levitard Show merchandise. You like South Beach Sessions? You listening in your car or in your headphones working out at the gym? Why don't you buy a shirt that says it?
Yeah. In the imaging that Angel did for Black Friday, do you think he considered instead of Billy just Roy's Black Friday?
I don't get it.